Ron, our intermission gives us a chance to sit down and talk with our performers in the day before the performance while they take a rest in real time. And the second half of the program starts with a piece by Robert Selig. And it was written specifically for Elizabeth Parcells and Christopher Oldfather, our pianist. Tell us, Betsy and Christopher, about the ease of preparing these pieces.
Well, I guess I can start on that one. It's not an easy piece. It's a musical piece. It's all very logical. Everything sort of fits. But it is the sort of piece that is time-consuming to prepare. That's really the only problem with it.
Why? What took time?
Well, there's a great deal the piano part is very thick, and pitches are difficult to distinguish as far as cues are concerned for the singer. So that it entails a lot of just going over and over the same spots over again and learning the pitches practically by, you know, memory.
It involves a whole lot of what we used to call woodshedding.
Yeah.
You just have to do it again, and do it again, and do it again. Pieces are interesting in that they allow for a lot of freedom of interpretation. I find it not at all frustrating to work the pieces up. So many new pieces, you start working on the things, and you can extract the content in about 30 seconds, you know, and then it's just a question of trying to find out what, just trying to mechanically project what you want, you know, and make it sound right. But these you kind of grow on you.
What part of the content, Christopher? The emotional content or the technical?
Yeah, basically emotional content. The rest of it is just trying to do the technical stuff that the guy demands from you. But these pieces you can kind of grow on them. They're more like a more classic song cycle. I think of more in the German Lieder tradition, although they're English.
Bob, how long did you work on these pieces? Pieces, you call them?
Yeah, pieces, right. How long did I work on them? I would say about 8 months, about 8 months or so.
That's not such a long time.
No, it took me on the average, well, let me say 6 weeks on the average per song. Usually the songs came very quickly, but it was the working out of the songs that took time. You know, that's the way I am. I usually get a concept, and that's very quick. It's the old lightning stroke thing that Hindemith talks about, where you see the thing in an instant, but you capture a landscape in an instant through a bright flash of light, you know? And it's true. It really does happen that way. But you don't capture every detail, but you capture the general gestalt, the general feeling and shape of the piece, or what Carter calls the dramatic shape. And then it's to work the details out, because the details in these songs are very subtle. The feedback between the pianist and the singer, is very, very, you can't, first of all, it can't be written. I mean, it's just something that has to be worked out between the two players. These two people did a wonderful job, incredible, miraculous job. And, I was ecstatic when I first heard them. And
did you take the material to them while you were working on the piece?
Yes, I had heard Elizabeth, Betsy, sing a Tanglewood. She sang a song cycle by John Adams, and I'd heard Betsy sing before, and I immediately wanted to write a piece for her voice. So I can actually say that, yes, it was written for a particular performer. And
did you write it for her or for her voice?
Well
that's a good question.
We talked about it quite a bit at Tanglewood. We were both there. That happened 2 summers ago. And we talked about it quite a bit over a lot of different lunches.
Right.
And basically the way we were both discussing it was definitely for the instrument itself. I mean, I had no particular soulful connection with the poetry or any such thing. It was merely a matter of finding a vocal instrument which would be proper or capable of performing the gestures that Bob had in mind. So, in fact, he used to ask me a lot, you know, oh, is this note going to be all right, or is that note too high, or this note too low? And I'd say, nah.
That's brave of you.
I never told you this, but you put that high E in the a cappella song, the Abroad, which is entirely without accompaniment, and said, is a high E all right? Is a high E all right? I said, sure. I didn't have a high E at the time. I just figured, you know, by the time I ever got around to singing them, I would have one.
Not only that, but you also had to bend up to an E quarter tone sharp.
Well, yeah.
It was almost an F.
But that sort of happens without hardly helping it at all. It just
usually sings an F anyway.
It's true, I make a terrible mistake. I run a little sharp on that song. Uh-huh. So I end up singing a high F.
How long did you know the poems, Bob, before you?
That's a good point. And I'd like to just make a quick mention. I don't want to hog this whole conversation up because it's really not my interview, but I will say one thing, that I did live with the poems for a long time. And it's the only way I can do anything dramatic is to feel each poem. This is another very ironic thing, because after talking to the poet, who's a friend of mine, our interpretations in some cases differed, but that's another thing. I think that he finally came around to agreeing that my way was just as good as his way. So, what I think is interesting that the audience probably should know is that the piece is basically structured as a six-movement symphony might be, or possibly a combination of a symphony concerto, whereas the first movement, The Stars, is kind of an opening. Kind of an angry, you know. It's you know, who thrust these stars against the sky? It's this huge question, and it's again, in a sense, the question is asked at the beginning, and finally in the last song, Branches, the answer comes, and the answer comes with the only piece in, that I consider really a tonal piece, a very warm lyric love song, in a sense, you know. Even though that the answer is there, there's still always the question, you know, even in the last song. So it's never completely answered. The second movement is a slower adagio. It's like a lyrical aria, in a sense, the gem. And the third one is Leaves at Night, which is a kind of a scherzo, kind of a mystical, kind of flighty piece, you know, very difficult to play and very difficult to sing. The fourth one, abroad, is the kind of cadenza, as you might find in a concerto. A solo cadenza for solo voice, absolutely no accompaniment at all. Struggle is the...
That's with the high E, right, Ben?
That's yeah. Right. Struggle is the clash. I mean, it's the rocking of the boat, the sexual connotation, of and all based on imagery of a ship, you know, the whole thing. And it's full of violence. And the violence in the storm is broken in the last song, Branches, the last movement of the sixth movement song cycle symphony.
Christopher, earlier you said something about the flexibility of interpretation. What did you mean? Is it some how the piece is written?
Yeah, is I think it's partly how they're written. Traditionally, songs have always been left way open for performance interpretation. There's always been a very strong tradition of playing with the things. And that style of writing, or that openness of writing, is not current today. The tendency today is just to demand this sort of thing. And one thing that I don't get demanded of, playing a lot of contemporary music a lot, is to play things with a lot of emotional content. And I feel like that's lacking a lot of people's music. And this piece is just here practically to excess. So.
It's me. It's excess all the way.
It's extremely expressive music in general. It just goes on.
Well, it's interesting to me that in the course of our rehearsals of it, that we've done very, very little talking about interpretation. In other words, the interpretation seemed to speak enough for itself that we didn't have to actually work it out between ourselves. We just sort of did it. And so that the only thing that was left to speak about was, in a rehearsal context, was the notes, the rhythms, the dynamic levels. And we didn't have to sit around and consider, you know, how this whole thing, what justification we had for expressing this phrase one way or another. We just went around and did it. The piece, from an interpretational point of view, really speaks for itself, the way most modern music does. It's all right there on the page, and you don't really have to tussle about it.
But you have to do it.
Well, you have to do it, yes. Yeah. But you don't have to talk about it.
In so many cases, the notes just become ends in themselves. And so much music is so... I guess it's just so carefully thought out, and the guy mm-hmm. just says, I want exactly this. Or, and he knows exactly this, and he'll tell you no. And then the technical aspect of the piece just becomes the entire piece.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes the content of the piece. But in this, you learn the notes, you know, and then you have to play it. You have to play it with your heart. You have to do it with your heart, or else there's nothing there.
That's true.
Yeah, I think
that's why it's so fun to do.
Well, it seems to me that my basic background seems to be one, like you say, it's a very romantic background. And I think that I never like to draw lines between what's subjective and what's objective in terms of any kinds of art at all, because I think they're both there in any kind of work of the mind and soul. All the notes are written out, first of all. There's no improvisation. The only improvisation is in the cadenza, where Betsy has the notes written. The rhythms are free. The phrases are generally given. But within this context is this great kind of elasticity that she has to mold this piece as she sees fit, as she feels at the time. Otherwise, everything is written, though some of the tempos have been changed. But the notes are there. There's with every other piece, there's nothing that I've left out. Every rhythm. And it's very exact, although the paradox is though the rhythm is exact, it doesn't always have to be played exactly as I wrote it. It can be done that way, but there is flexibility within exactness.
Then the music does, in fact, become a means instead of an end.
Yes.
Itself, as you said.
I wanted to write something that I felt I could express in my very deep feelings. I was telling Betsy I thought it was one of my best pieces.
And it can thus become the vehicle for those same feelings from the performer.
That exactly.
Can you capsulize how Richard Moore, the poet, reacted to the pieces when he heard them?
He wasn't sure. Richard is, I guess, not quite a devotee of contemporary music. I don't know. I can't really speak for him. He wants to hear them again. Let's put it like that.
Pretty funny sounding stuff.
Kind of like that. Yeah.
Well, we have our chance tonight, and I can speak for the station. We're excited to be able to have the first concert performance here, although we recorded them earlier this year on another series.
Yes, we did.
For
two
the composer
very, very
show.
Brutal sessions.
Oh gosh, two.
Well, that's right, 2 days.
Take 56. Take 57. Take most frustrating. Oh. Very frustrating way to do things.
One of the new problems must be now to be able to go through them nonstop.
Altogether. Yes, that's true. Because we did everything in such choppy takes, and then just. Through some miracle, I'm sure one of your very smart technicians just managed to patch it all together. But I was worried that after having that kind of an experience with the piece for a first performance, that was our first recording of it, that I wouldn't be able to string it all together and keep the energy going throughout. It was an interesting experience.
Can you tell us something about the Strauss?
Well. The other two pieces that I chose for this concert I took very seriously because I wanted to flank the Zelig with two very good, worthwhile, and somehow related pieces. I think the Stravinsky, again, speaks for itself. The Strauss is interesting because it was written late in his career. It's Opus 68, and is, though it is composed near the middle of the 20th century, a very romantic piece, or neo-romantic, if you will. And somehow it's such a logical thing to come after that last song, The Branches, which the beginning of the Zelig group starts very, well, I don't know what the proper term is, atonal, for lack of a better word, and kind of progresses into a very tonal resolution. And suddenly we come on with still a 20th century piece, but one which reflects the same kind of tonal influences that the last song just left off with.
Strauss is really the ne plus ultra of romanticism. It's just the end.
Yeah.
The last, mm-hmm. I think.
So I think it makes an interesting program that way, going from Stravinsky, which were written in about 1911 through 1915 or so, to the Zelig, which is very recent, to the Strauss, which is less recent than this one, but more recent than the first one. It's a very strange kind of really.
And after we figure that out,
I'm sorry, it took me a long time to figure that one out myself. But you know, I think it really makes the 20th century in a nutshell, the kind of schizophrenia that's been going through music for the 20th century.
Even more schizophrenic, he wrote it right in the middle of the Second World War and lived in Germany. He didn't leave Germany. And the pieces just have nothing to do with any of that at all.
Yeah.
Just wasn't concerned with that at all. You know, his world was just collapsing all around him.
Isn't that true, though, with many composers? Their psychic life is a lot different from their personal life.
That's I think so, yeah.
It has to be, I think.
Well, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, and I want to thank you all, and thank you, Christopher, Robert, Betsy. We'll be returning in a moment for music of Robert Zelig. But first, let's pause for station identification.